more than speak softly and carry a big stick. We have to start swinging that stick if we're going to survive. The Progressive Islamist Alliance accused George W. Bush of being a crusader. They believed the myth that the Crusades were Christian aggression against Islam. The truth is, the Crusades were a response to hundreds of years of Muslim aggression. Here's the problem. The West stopped fighting the Crusades when the Muslims were thrown out of Europe. But the Muslims didn't. They've continued their thousand-year war against civilization right up to the present. They were contained for a time by Western economic, social, and military superiority. Now they're loose again, thanks to the progressive Islamist Arab Spring. We need a new Richard the Lionheart. We're facing worldwide jihad, just as Richard and his successors faced during the Middle Ages. It's going to take a real leader commanding a refocused military to defeat it. The American public is dying for a warrior king crusader. That explains why American Sniper is the most popular movie of modern times. Why do you think it grossed $100 million over a single weekend? Because we'd like a sniper to run for president, to be our warrior king crusader, to save this country before it's too late. Right now, we have a sorority running the military as a social services organization. That's not what a military establishment is supposed to do. I have no problem with women, homosexuals, minorities, or anyone else voicing grievances, as long as their opponents are free to disagree when those grievances are unfounded. But the military is not the proper forum for this. It is not a town hall. It is a martial institution with one purpose and one purpose only: to destroy the enemy before it destroys us. The military must be run by people who have the strength to take decisive action when it is needed, and the restraint to avoid action when it is not in the interests of the people. We have exactly the opposite in charge now. We have a group of progressive academics who won't say the word Islamic when describing the real enemy. As ISIS rampages through the Middle East, they are more concerned with not offending Muslims than protecting Western civilization from its greatest threat since Hitler and Stalin. At the same time, they treated the military like a new toy they got for Christmas when overthrowing governments during the Arab Spring. They were like a 2-year-old with a machine gun, shooting in all directions because he doesn't know any better. They destroyed stable, relatively secular governments and replaced them with radical Islamist ones, almost without exception. It's hard to believe it all wasn't intentional. Both the progressives and the Islamofascists have an interest in destroying the world order. Intentional or not, that's just what both groups are doing. They are truly fellow travelers. The world order wasn't perfect before the progressive Islamist onslaught. Nothing constructed by human beings ever is, but it did keep America safe for 70 years. Whether you like it or not, that's the truth. Did America support some oppressive governments? Yes, there isn't really another kind in the Middle East, outside of Israel. Now we're seeing the other side of the story. We can see just what kind of people those dictators were repressing. Whom do you prefer? The dictators or the radical Islamists? Did getting rid of Gaddafi make Libya freer and safer? Did it increase or decrease American national security? Was Egypt freer under the Muslim Brotherhood than it was under Mubarak, a U.S. ally? Hillary Clinton famously boasted after he was killed, "We came, we saw, he died," to the cackles of her feminist cadre. The truth is, there were no good choices in most of these countries before the progressives blew them up. Former administrations recognized this and did the best they could, forging partnerships with lesser evils to advance U.S. interests. That meant a strong alliance with Israel and cooperation with traditional Sunni allies like Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia. A warrior king knows how to pick his battles. He knows when to negotiate and with whom. He risks military conflict only when it's in his country's interests, and then he commits to destroy the enemy, not win hearts and minds. The enemies we're facing right now do not have winnable hearts or minds. They aren't going to be dissuaded by a government jobs program. We need to face reality and elect the kind of leadership that will deal with the enemy as they truly are. As Richard Gabriel writes in Military History magazine, "It's unfortunate that in today's world, the Arabic word jihad is most directly associated with heinous terrorist acts committed by Islamic extremists who either don't know or don't care about the word's origin and true meaning. The doctrine of jihad, or holy war, was Muhammad's principal military legacy. It is indisputable that divinely justified warfare became a force of major importance during the early Islamic period, was a significant motivator for the Muslim conquests that followed Muhammad's death in 632, and remains a primary characteristic of Islamic warfare. Pre-Islamic Arabia knew no notion of ideology of any sort, and certainly no notion of religiously sanctioned war. Do you understand what he's saying? Jihad is not an aberration within Islam by a few radical elements. It is a foundational part of the religion itself. It has underpinned Islam since Muhammad and remains a driving force within mainstream Islam today. It doesn't just inspire terrorism. It inspires the conflict Muslims have with their neighbors in all the countries I told you about in the last chapter. We're in desperate need of a new Richard the Lionheart as president, who puts aside the panty waists who have run this country off the rails. Not tomorrow, not after many of us are decimated, right now. He wouldn't sit here waiting for sleeper cells to strike, even after the FBI has opened investigations of ISIS in 49 states. He would hit them before they hit us. This assumes we have leadership that isn't playing for the other side. The Islamofascists are fighting a religiously sanctioned war, if you consider Islam a religion at all. Retired U.S. Admiral James Ace Lyons doesn't. He said, "Until you recognize Islam as a political movement masquerading as a religion, you're never going to come to grips with it." How else could you describe these maniacs who are willing to kill boys in Iraq, machine gun them for watching soccer in the name of Allah? No religion would teach that. These are the brutal tactics of a Jacobin political movement. That's one more thing the progressives and Islamofascists have in common. Admiral Lyons pointed out something else I've been saying for years. We had our chance to stop the Islamofascists before it came to this. We could have stopped them when they took our hostages in Iran, but Jimmy Carter is part of the progressive Islamic alliance. We could have stopped them after they bombed our embassy in Lebanon, but Reagan's order to respond was disobeyed by Caspar Weinberger. There is blame to go around for both sides of our one-party system. Now we're back to where we were in the Middle Ages, with the Islamofascists on the march toward Vienna. This is not World War I. We are not fighting European nations who recognize international rules of war. We're fighting throwback lunatics who don't realize it's 2015, and who rape, murder, and torture as their ancestors did 1,000 years ago. We don't need a jobs program. We don't need diversity in the Air Force. We don't need equal opportunity for mullahs. We need a warrior king crusader to rebuild our military and defend Western civilization once again. The Vikings' fate. If you think social engineering of the U.S. military is without consequences, I invite my skeptical readers to study the Danish or Swedish military of today. After many a decade of progressiveness, the descendants of Vikings are today unable or unwilling to defend their homeland against an Islamist invasion. Witness the capitulation. Thank the progressives, the gays, the feminists, and the socialists. Is this what you want for the United States? To be a helpless giant? Chapter 5. Zero Education. Contrary to what you have been told by our progressive media, the United States spends more per student on education than any other nation in the world. We spend over $15,000 per student annually. Yet, U.S. students rank 24th in literacy and 31st in math literacy. Across the board, U.S. students perform poorly compared to other countries that spend less per student on education. How can that be? There are a lot of answers to that question. One of them is that American public schools don't spend a large percentage of their time teaching reading, writing, and arithmetic. Instead, they spend it indoctrinating children into the progressive religion. This means teaching them to hate or mistrust everything that made Western civilization in general, and America in particular, the freest, most prosperous civilization in human history. There is a direct connection between the phony economic recovery and the destruction of American education. What the government calls unemployment continues to fall, even though unemployed people don't actually get jobs. They just give up looking for work and become permanent residents on the welfare rolls. Our education system is contributing significantly to this disastrous trend. The federal government has been increasingly involved in education since Jimmy Carter created the Department of Education in 1979. It's no accident that school and student performance has plummeted almost from that moment on. Thomas Sowell once wrote, "The most fundamental fact about the ideas of the political left is that they do not work. Therefore, we should not be surprised to find the left concentrated in institutions where ideas do not have to work in order to survive." That couldn't be truer than for education, a field dominated by leftists for more than a century. From what students are taught, to how they're taught, to how it's all paid for, education is a microcosm for the epic failure of progressivism over the past 100 years. Lesson 1. People are evil. One of the first things our progressive schools teach kids is to believe they're evil, to feel guilty they were ever born. Does that sound outrageous to you? It isn't. If you don't believe me, ask your own child what he or she has learned about science in school. You may hear some basics like photosynthesis or the order of the planets in the solar system, but before long, you'll find out that your child has also been taught that human beings are bad. Human beings upset the fictitious balance of nature and cause the extinction of animal and plant species. They're also taught the global warming lie, starting at as early an age as possible. Much of this is driven by the increasingly centralized control over curriculum by the Federal Department of Education. As I told you in my last book, Stop the Coming Civil War, the federal government hasn't mandated a national curriculum yet. Instead, it has bribed states into adopting its dictates through federal funding in return for adoption of national standards like Common Core. Conservatives instinctively resist national control of education, and their instincts are correct. Take a look at the first 10 lesson plans that were listed on the science page of kids.gov, the federal government website providing educational resources for children to study in science class. Air pollution. What's the solution? Air Quality Index, AQI Toolkit for teachers. Air Quality Resources for teachers. Conservation Central Online Curriculum. Eco World Lesson Plans. Energy Education, Teach and Learn. Energy Lesson Plans and Activities. Energy Star Kids. Estuaries.gov Educators Page. Fossil Fuels for Younger Students. Have you noticed a recurring theme? Does this look to you like a comprehensive overview of anything you'd recognize as a primary or secondary school education in science? Or does it look more like the agenda for a radical environmentalist rally? The rest of the list is similarly skewed toward phony environmental science. There are at most 3 lesson plan categories representing purely scientific subjects like geology, biology, or rudimentary engineering. The rest are largely propaganda to teach children actions students can take to protect their health and reduce air pollution, or how you and your classmates can make big changes and help save the world. As you might have guessed, the Energy Education, Teach and Learn section teaches kids about all of the wonderful green energy research being done by crony capitalists getting rich on taxpayers' money. But don't expect to find the most important thing children should learn about these ripoffs. They've all been miserable failures. All of this is part of the larger narrative that people and the modern world we've created are inherently evil. We're a scourge that upsets the fictitious balance of nature and is killing Gaia, the Earth goddess. Only our benevolent, omnipotent rulers in Washington can save the Earth from people and people from themselves. Earlier this year, the Detroit Opera House presented The Very Last Green Thing. The opera depicts students of the future taking a field trip outside. This is a rare occasion in the story because the air is so polluted. Goggles and masks are required just to survive outdoors. It's not a very original story. There are at least a dozen similar stories in leftist 20th century literature, most of them more interesting than this one. What makes this noteworthy is that it was performed by the children themselves. Using the power of music as a particularly devious but effective tactic employed by radical environmentalists to indoctrinate children early on to their religion. Most people are familiar with how Hitler used music as an emotional tool to brainwash the public. This is no different. In Fort Campbell, Kentucky, pre-kindergarten students put on a fashion show featuring clothing they made entirely out of recycled materials contributed by their parents. The kids made everything from dresses to accessories to environmentally friendly superhero attire. This doesn't sound so bad in a vacuum. The kids had fun, and there's nothing wrong with learning to make clothing by hand, nor to appreciate recycling. But listen to the rhetoric from one of the pre-K teachers involved in the project. "We read books about recycling. We talked about Earth Day and how we can save the planet. At this age, they're very impressionable, and their parents are listening to what they're saying," said Emmanuel. So, the teacher acknowledges the kids are impressionable and that she is instilling ideas that will stay with them into adulthood. And that is the primary lesson they're taking out of preschool, before they're in any way able to critically analyze it? The planet must be saved. From what, you ask? From people. Ask yourself what this means to a young, impressionable child. It teaches that child to feel guilty about being a human being. It attempts to imbue him with the self-loathing at the root of progressivism. This is where it starts. Indoctrinating children into any ideology before they are intellectually equipped to question it is evil in and of itself. But it's especially evil to teach them to feel guilty for being born. That's what the whole environmental movement is based upon. They want to convince people their very existence is evil, resulting in a debt they can never repay, no matter how much they're taxed. They begin encouraging children to form an emotional bond to this idea at a very young age. That makes it even harder for them to question it later in life when they have the intellectual capacity to do so. Some people can never overcome the emotional bonds they formed as children to progressive ideas. That's why reason doesn't work in persuading them. Lesson 2. The free market is evil. For those who think I'm exaggerating the extent to which children are brainwashed into radical environmentalism, let me issue a challenge. Show me a classroom that has children singing songs and doing art projects celebrating capitalism and free enterprise. I won't hold my breath. Ask your child what he learned about the Industrial Revolution. Again, you'll hear a few basic facts. You'll hear about the emergence of mass production, the assembly line, and maybe even a few of the many inventions of those greedy white males like Edison and Bell. But if you talk to your child for more than a few minutes, you'll eventually hear the progressive lie about that wonderful time in human history. You'll hear the Industrial Revolution created child labor and monopolies run by robber barons who exploited their workers. You will hear the early progressive governments came in and saved us all from capitalism. What is this teaching children? It teaches them the free market is inherently bad, or at least dangerous, and the government is a benevolent force that protects us from it. They are never taught the unintended negative consequences of government regulation. They are never taught that the Sherman Antitrust Act was lobbied for by Standard Oil's competitors so they could charge consumers higher prices for oil. I wasn't taught this in school. Were you? Here is something else you never learned in school. The Industrial Revolution actually ended child labor by making parents productive enough to not need their children to work. It was a sad reality that children had to work in factories to ensure the family could eat, but child labor didn't start during the Industrial Revolution. Child labor was a fact of life for all of human history. The work children did in factories during the Industrial Revolution was actually much easier than the back-breaking work they did previously on the farm. The government was only able to pass child labor laws when families no longer needed children to work. Had child labor laws been passed before the Industrial Revolution, the children would have starved. Why else would parents make their children work? Do you actually believe parents were sadistic monsters or greedy slave drivers in the 19th century? It's ridiculous, but that's what government schools have taught whole generations to believe. They have taught them to believe illogical, ridiculous lies. This is only one of them. Those so-called monopolies and robber barons are just more of the same progressive nonsense. Did you know that Standard Oil had hundreds of competitors when the Sherman Antitrust Act was passed? Did you know that Standard Oil had lowered its prices for decades before the government broke it up, making life for the middle class and poor a little easier? I didn't learn that in school. I'll bet you didn't either. I know what you must be saying. Savage, now you've gone too far. This sounds like an implausible conspiracy theory where everyone is out to brainwash us. That's not what I'm saying. You have to understand the history of public schooling and the progressive agenda. They've had control over public schools for over 100 years. Most of the teachers who advance the agenda don't even realize they're doing it. Most are well-intentioned, public-spirited people who want to educate children. They were taught these progressive lies by teachers who themselves didn't know any better. Now they're passing the lies on to those who will teach your grandchildren or great-grandchildren. The only reason there are any conservatives left in this country is progressivism is inherently unrealistic and self-contradictory. Many, many conservatives started out as liberals, but the real world showed them how horrible this life-denying philosophy really is. They cured themselves of progressivism. Lesson 3. American culture is evil. Along with junk science and phony progressive history, public schools also teach multiculturalism as a required subject. There isn't any one classroom or teacher dedicated to this. It's taught in all classes, all the time. I should clarify. I mean progressive multiculturalism, which is the celebration of all cultures except one, American culture. Speaking in grammatically correct American English is not part of the agenda. Students who speak English as a second language or who actually can't speak any language properly at all are given first priority. They have to be accommodated, even if it means students who read, write, and speak English very well suffer. Earlier this year, students at Pine Bush High School in upstate New York catcalled and denounced their student body president for reciting the Pledge of Allegiance during the morning announcements. Some students actually sat down in protest. Believe it or not, I couldn't have been happier to hear it. I was happy because it wasn't the pledge the students were protesting, but the language it was recited in. As part of its efforts to celebrate National Foreign Language Week, this school's administration thought it would be just wonderful to have the Pledge to Our Flag recited in the language of the maniacs who burn our flag. Wouldn't that show how tolerant and accepting we progressive Americans are? These pedantic academics are constantly trying to provoke clear-thinking people with stunts like this. From depicting Jesus as black, to recasting classic male heroes as women, to this latest stupidity, they continually attempt to shock people into realizing how racist or sexist or close-minded they are. They just can't wait to say, "Oh, are you shocked by that? Aren't you glad I made you recognize your subconscious prejudices? Aren't I just wonderful?" According to Fox News, the school said the pledge was recited in Arabic as a way to honor National Foreign Language Week, and in an effort to celebrate the many races, cultures, and religions that make up this great country. Really? Public schools celebrate races, cultures, and religions? What week do they celebrate Caucasians, American culture, and Christianity? They don't. Those are not allowed. To celebrate those would be racist, intolerant, and theocratic. Don't you realize how oppressive white people have been to other races? Don't you realize American culture is capitalist and built on slavery and exploitation of low-paid workers? Don't you realize we have a separation of church and state? Guess what? The kids in this school weren't buying it. Whatever other progressive nonsense they've unknowingly accepted, that inherent common sense that eventually led Reagan away from liberalism must have kicked in, and they fought back. Eventually, the school issued an apology. Score one for the good guys, at least for now. Conservatives won that battle, but they're losing the war in public schools. The progressive narrative that Muslims are a persecuted minority and Islam a misunderstood religion of peace is too well-funded and pervasive. In a school in Wisconsin, students were given an assignment to pretend you are Muslim. The assignment asked students to give three examples of what you do daily for your religion and any struggles you face. This would be funny if it weren't so tragic. I'm wondering if any of the students had the presence of mind to say, I have more trouble practicing my Christian religion than Muslims do practicing theirs. It would certainly be true. Referring to God as Allah is perfectly acceptable in public schools, while referring to God as God, or Jesus, is strictly prohibited. Think about how far the school environment has deteriorated to get to the point where an assignment like this could be given to students, while any reference to the Christian religion is banned. Can you imagine the uproar if the word Christian were substituted for Muslim in this assignment? How about if the teacher asked students to imagine they were a Christian living in Western Iraq right now? Which group is more persecuted, Muslims in America or Christians in Iraq? I doubt most American schoolchildren today could answer that question correctly. Marcuse and Fromm for Kids. In my last book, I told you about Herbert Marcuse and Erich Fromm, who were intellectual leaders in the sexual revolution of the 1950s and 60s. If you didn't read it, let me sum it up for you. The sexual revolution was all about moving America toward socialism. Marcuse and Fromm believed that if Americans were liberated from sexual repression, they would give up their individual liberty and become functionaries of the state, whose only value was greater degrees of hedonism. I'd say they were quite successful, wouldn't you? Look around you. Look at the prevalence of sexual license in all areas of American culture. From music videos to movies to the most popular websites on the internet, porn sites, Americans are literally saturated with sex. The sexual revolution succeeded in breaking down all morality and restraint in the sexual lives of adults. Sex education and free condoms are accomplishing the same thing in schools. I'm sure if you made that last statement to any of your liberal friends, they'd screech, "What? You don't want teenagers to have condoms? Are you against safe sex? Don't you care about the children's health care?" These are the kinds of replies you get from liberals. If a conservative says anything about condoms, liberals automatically assume they want them legally banned. That's because they only understand two approaches to anything: ban it or subsidize it. That people should choose what they want to buy, pay for it with their own money, and take responsibility for the consequences just doesn't occur to progressives. If teenagers are going to have premarital sex, it's obvious they are better off using condoms than not using them. But what about not encouraging them to have sex in the first place? Isn't that what handing out free condoms in school does? Is it not still an accepted economic principle that when you subsidize something, you get more of it? By subsidizing condoms in schools, you are going to get more kids in schools having sex. Do I even have to ask if more teenage sex is a good thing? Are more teenage pregnancies a good thing? More teenagers with STDs? By the way, redefining condoms as health care is a linguistic coup that puts Orwell's newspeak to shame. Even Goebbels would have been proud. Suddenly, condoms become the same as cancer treatments or heart surgery. Then liberals can cry, "How can you heartless conservatives deny children health care?" I'm sure you remember Sandra Fluke making the condoms are health care argument to Congress in trying to get them subsidized. It didn't end there. She's inspired a high school senior in Gainesville, Florida, to make the same argument in getting condoms provided by taxpayers in her public school. The aptly named Kira Christmas decided taxpayers should be Santa Claus when it comes to condoms, regardless of their relatively affordable cost, even for low-income earners. She started a petition to garner support. The only problem was the school district superintendent. He objected to the idea on what has unfortunately become very unusual grounds. Teaching kids about birth control, disease prevention, those kinds of things, but as far as actually giving out condoms, that's really a parental role, a family role. That is not something that the school district should be taking on, said spokesperson Jackie Johnson. Imagine that. Educating children and making decisions regarding their sexual activity should be left up to parents. What a novel idea. It might be too dangerous, though. If parents were allowed to make decisions regarding their children's sexual education, they might start asserting a right to make decisions regarding all aspects of their children's education. We can't have that, can we? The school's superintendent eventually caved to the pressure and reversed his decision prohibiting condom distribution in Alachua schools. The compromise the school board made was to allow parents to opt out of the program. They can't opt out of paying for free condoms for school children, but they can fill out a form and send it into the school. The school nurses will refuse to distribute condoms to those students whose parents have dutifully filled out the government form. One of the most disturbing aspects of this story is the extent to which local students have been brainwashed into the progressive socialist mindset. A foundational socialist plank since Plato has been that the government should raise and educate children rather than parents. This is what Hillary Clinton really meant when she said, "It takes a village to raise a child." Apparently, at least some young people in the school district believe the government does a better job as well. A freshman student at University of Florida writes in his school paper, "Parents, on the other hand, often live in states of euphoric ignorance. Many are unaware of their children's sex lives, and they avoid potentially awkward conversations by settling for the sexual education their kids receive in school. Changing family dynamics and facilitating conversations about the importance of safe sex will take much more time, so until then, we need schools to help students overcome these obstacles." Another teenage student, presumably from the Alachua School District, echoed Wilde's sentiments. "If your parents don't want to talk about it, they feel awkward, then it's a good thing to have, like, a nurse there just willing to do it." Yes, parents are incompetent and inadequate when it comes to raising their own children, so the government has to help, until such time as family dynamics can be changed. These comments could have been made by Vladimir Lenin. It's horrifying that they came from American teenagers. It looks like government schools are at least succeeding at one thing: producing good little socialists. The Common Progressive Islamist Core. The power-hungry maniacs out to steal the minds and souls of our children aren't satisfied with merely taking power away from parents. They also want power over education taken away from your local school board and even your state. If they get their way, only the National Ministry of Truth will decide what children learn or don't learn in school. This is what Common Core is really about. Last year, Wyoming prohibited adoption of the National Academy of Social Sciences, NGSS, standards for K-12 education because they included teaching global warming as established science. They included a prohibition in their 2014 to 2016 budget for any use of funds to review the standards. The progressive jackals went wild and launched an all-out campaign against the legislators. On March 2, 2015, the Wyoming governor signed a bill overturning the prohibition and allowing the State Board of Education to review the standards. It is only a matter of time before the Board of Education approves the standards, and another example of grassroots resistance to the progressive agenda is crushed. This is how it happens: one progressive lie at a time. If left unchecked, this set of standards or some other will be adopted in every state, and generations of children will grow up not knowing anyone ever questioned the climate change scam, just as they've grown up never knowing Standard Oil lowered its prices for 2 decades before being broken up by the government. That was why I warned readers about Common Core in my last book, Stop the Coming Civil War. It's not only because it's ineffective. We've all seen Common Core's processes for doing what used to be simple math problems lampooned on the internet. It's not only because it adopts every progressive lie ever told as established scientific or historical fact. One of the men who actually wrote the Common Core standards admitted this at a debate at St. Anselm's College in Manchester, New Hampshire last year. "The reason why I helped write the standards, and the reason why I am here today, is that as a white male in society, I've been given a lot of privilege that I didn't earn," said David Pook. Of course, Pook is going to have a hard time determining whether the standards will truly overcome the white privilege he believes exists. That's because the exclusive New Hampshire prep school he teaches at has only 7 black students currently enrolled, out of a total student body of 369. This typical limousine liberal may go whole days without even seeing a black student. What is most dangerous about Common Core is its potential to become the required set of educational standards for all schools, public or private. Just imagine if the list of lesson plans I provided from kids.gov became the standard curriculum in every public school. That's what progressives really want. If they can make Common Core mandatory, no non-progressive will ever emerge from an American school again. That's why it has to be stopped. Over the past year, there has actually been some good news on this front. Parents across the nation and across the political spectrum are taking a stand against Common Core. Believe it or not, liberal New York State is leading the charge. 95% of eligible children at Brooklyn New School didn't take Common Core tests administered in April 2015. 75% of their peers joined them at West Seneca Central School, outside Buffalo, New York. In all, an estimated 200,000 eligible students will have opted out of these tests statewide. The opt-out movement isn't confined to New York. New Jersey, Colorado, and California now have growing opt-out movements, with more expected to follow. Richard Brodsky of the liberal think tank Demos called the opt-out movement a citizen revolt. For once, I agree with him. That's just what it is. I don't mean to imply that millions of progressives have suddenly seen the light and become conservatives. Different groups of people oppose Common Core for different reasons. Teachers' unions, like all unions, don't want their members accountable to anyone in any way. Liberal parents who oppose any kind of grading and want everyone in sports competitions to receive a trophy oppose Common Core testing because it's just too stressful and may bruise the self-esteem of their precious little snowflakes. Whatever their reasons, it's apparent that opposition to Common Core is not an exclusively Republican or conservative position. Conservatives and liberals are instinctively resisting it. Yet, the federal government continues to shove it down our throats. That's government zero. The government doesn't represent conservatives. It doesn't even represent the progressives who elected it. It represents itself and pursues its agenda regardless of the will of the people. The biggest bubble yet? I've been talking about the higher education bubble for some time now. It has continued to grow since my last book and may be nearing a breaking point. Earlier this year, the Federal Reserve reported that only 37% of borrowers are current on their loans and are actively paying them down, and 17% are in default or in delinquency. That means a staggering 63% of student loan borrowers are behind on payments or in default. Just to put things in perspective, the average default rate expected in most commercial markets is a little over 1%. According to Investopedia, as of January 2015, the default rate for a broad swath of the credit services industry, including first and second mortgages, auto loans, and bank cards, was 1.12%. For every $100 that was lent, $1.12 was defaulted on, or not paid back. If the federal government weren't guaranteeing the loans, which forces you to pay them back when the students default, this bubble would have exploded long ago. But that can go on for only so long. Remember, government-backed loans by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac played the same role in the housing meltdown. In reality, the education bubble is identical to the housing and dot-com bubbles. It has all the same symptoms resulting from all the same government interventions. First and foremost, we have a central bank that has inflated the currency beyond any historical precedent. This is the only reason there are enough U.S. dollars in existence to lend to every single high school graduate who wants one. When money is scarce, lenders give loans only to the most creditworthy individuals. When there is a virtually infinite supply of money, lenders will eventually make loans to all comers, regardless of creditworthiness, especially when they have nothing to lose if the borrower defaults. So, just as in the dot-com and housing bubbles, the first culprit in this bubble is the Federal Reserve. If they hadn't created an unlimited supply of money, the rest of the problem would be academic. Of course, it doesn't end there. Disasters like the housing meltdown require a symphony of bad policy, and we have a true maestro in that regard occupying the White House. The next movement in the symphony is the guarantee itself. This is the same moral hazard everyone talked about with the Greenspan put in the 1990s and the Fannie and Freddie guarantees in the 2000s. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that when the government says it will pay back any loans that default, more are going to default. The truly immoral part of this equation is they're making you pay for this. Why should taxpayers be financially responsible to pay back money borrowed by people they don't even know and whose decisions they have no control over? What possible justification is there for this, other than the usual socialist mantras? The combination of unlimited, cheap supplies of money and the moral hazard of government-backed loans is having the same effect on the education sector of the economy as it had on the housing sector. It's hard to believe, so few seem to see it. College tuitions continue to outpace inflation, just as housing prices did. This isn't hard to understand. Guaranteeing loans to everyone artificially increases demand. Remember, demand isn't just the desire to purchase, it's also the ability to purchase. When the government guarantees loans to everyone with your money, demand explodes and prices with it. The bubble also misallocates resources. Do you remember all those people in the house building business who lost their jobs in 2008? They shouldn't have been working in the house building business to begin with. There wasn't enough real demand to support all those employees in that sector. So why didn't they just get jobs in another industry when the bubble popped? Because the jobs weren't there. The capital that would have created them had all flowed to housing, where profits were guaranteed while the bubble lasted. Do you see how the harmful effects of government intervention multiply geometrically? When the education bubble pops, the same thing is going to happen to millions of people employed in the education sector. They're going to be out of work with no prospects and no skills to bring to a new job. They'll just join the record number of Americans receiving government welfare benefits, thanks to the food stamp president. It couldn't work out better for the progressives bent on destroying the American economy and overwhelming the system, just as Cloward and Piven suggested. If you aren't familiar with them, I'll talk more about them in a later chapter. Employees aren't the only resources misallocated by the bubble. It also artificially inflates the number of people who choose to go to college in the first place. I'm going to say something that I'm sure will send liberals into apoplectic shock. Everyone should not go to college. That's right. You heard that correctly. I'm sure somehow that will be interpreted as racist, sexist, or at least heartless. But it's not racist. It's not sexist. It's not heartless. And it's not fattening. It's the truth. We didn't always assume that everyone, or even most people, should go to college. College used to be a place you went if you were planning on a career in medicine, law, engineering, or other specialized professions. People planning on other lines of work didn't waste the money to go to college because their money and time was more wisely invested in apprenticeships and other practical work experience. The idea that people have to go to college in order to be successful is a new one. It's also complete baloney. Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, Larry Ellison, and John Paul DeJuria are just a few contemporary billionaires who didn't get a college degree. Mark Zuckerberg doesn't have one. Even our leftist propagandist David Geffen doesn't have one. This is nothing new. A large percentage of the most successful people in American history did not earn college degrees. From Benjamin Franklin and Abraham Lincoln to Henry Ford to Wendy's Dave Thomas. Neither Frederick Henry Royce, co-founder of Rolls-Royce, nor George Eastman, founder of Kodak, had college degrees. There are hundreds more examples. That doesn't mean you have to be a history-making entrepreneur to be successful without a college degree either. I know dozens of small business people making six-figure incomes doing electrical work, landscaping, plumbing, and even janitorial work. Many of these businesses are starving for quality employees, while college graduates with useless degrees are working fast food jobs or living in their parents' basements. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying every single individual in this country should not have an equal opportunity to attend college if he or she wants to. What I am saying is that each individual should have to take responsibility for that decision. Similarly, banks who make huge profits on student loans should also take responsibility for the money they lend. Taxpayers shouldn't be bailing out students or banks. If that were the case, students would have to make prudent choices on whether or not to go to college and, more important, what they are going to learn there. Banks would have to consider the chances the student has of paying back the loan out of the money he or she will earn after graduation. That is exactly the opposite of what is happening in our bubble education economy right now. According to the federal government's National Center for Education Statistics, the top five majors in terms of degrees earned in 2010 to 2011 were business, social sciences and history, health professions and related programs, education, and psychology. Three out of these five majors rank in the bottom 20 in terms of earning potential for graduates. That means most students entering college right now are choosing the majors least likely to help them earn enough money to pay back their student loans. Those entering education in particular are setting themselves up to be sitting at ground zero when the education bubble explodes. It's tragic. So, what does Obama suggest we do in the face of this problem that has been building up for generations? Make it worse. His pay-as-you-earn, P-A-Y-E, program just encourages more of everything that caused the problem. There is no incentive against taking out tens or hundreds of thousands in student loans to subsidize a low-paying major, when you will be required to pay only 10% of your income in payments, regardless of how low your income may be. Don't get me wrong, I'm not blaming all of this on Obama. That idiot George W. Bush did exactly the same thing, while the Federal Reserve blew up a housing bubble on his watch. He cheered on his ownership society, while the bubble got bigger and bigger. He further nationalized education with No Child Left Behind, doubling the size of the Department of Education, Republicans used to vow to abolish. That doesn't make Obama's policies any better. Just as in every other area, he's doubled down on the mistakes of the past, while managing to make new ones no other president would have dreamed of. Sooner or later, the education party is going to end, just as housing did. The banks don't have to worry. The Dodd-Frank Act has made them even more too big to fail than they were in 2008. The losers will be the rest of us. Unemployed college graduates with useless degrees in art or women's studies. Small businesses that can't expand for lack of skilled workers. And society in general suffering the effects of a dumbed-down, brainwashed, unskilled, and unemployable population that is increasingly dependent on the government handouts that help the progressives keep winning elections. Our most important fight. You can begin to see why American students do so poorly compared to students in countries that spend less on education. It's also why the Democratic Party wins elections. The two phenomena are related. The school system spends most of its time teaching kids things that aren't true, and almost no time teaching them things that are. They learn a completely false version of history and junk science like global warming, while their competitors in other countries are developing advanced skills. Meanwhile, American students can't read, write, or speak their own language properly. They're taught math in a way that even parents with graduate degrees in math can't understand. Common Core discourages reading the classics and encourages reading reports generated by the Federal Reserve. Do you think they'll be able to recognize history repeating itself reading government reports instead of the classics? Not likely. American students are constantly brainwashed with the idea that Muslims are viciously persecuted in America, regardless of the evidence of a growing, active, jihadist population in our midst. They are taught to believe the mere mention of God or Jesus on public property is discriminatory, while the murder, rape, and torture of Christians by radical Islamists is rationalized away. Overall, the school system produces the prototypical Democratic voter. He or she is completely ignorant of real history, incompetent in critical thinking, unable to understand or express complex ideas, and unprepared to learn the specialized skills that make him or her competitive in the 21st century marketplace. This student graduates with a learned suspicion of entrepreneurs and no suspicion of government. They learn abortion is a right, but private property is not. They are encouraged to have sex, but are discouraged from entering the workforce, even if college isn't the best thing for them at that point in their lives. They emerge from high school feeling guilty about who they are, if they are white or male, and aggrieved and victimized if they are female or a minority. They become low-information voters, even if they go on to get college degrees. Meanwhile, the economic policies that have created and continue to expand the education bubble continue to steer students toward useless majors, dominated by leftist professors who teach students no marketable skills, but imbue them with progressive Islamist brainwashing. education may be the most important fight we have. Unless we can change these trends, there won't be enough clear-thinking, self-sufficient, patriotic Americans left to defeat the dark forces trying to destroy our civilization. I'll tell you what I believe we have to do at the end of this book. Chapter 6. Zero Culture. First World to Third World. America's culture has gone from first world to third world status. It's swimming in a mire of sex, drugs, base entertainment, class envy, entitlement, and apathy. Welcome to the new progressive Islamist America. Today, the average American high school senior has lived his whole life being told that businessmen are evil, minorities are viciously persecuted in America, Islam is the religion of peace, and Christianity and Judaism are the religions of white privilege, ignorance, and intolerance. He is taught to loathe himself if he is white and male, or to consider him or herself persecuted if a minority or female, whether it's true or not. Kids haven't just learned this in school. It's reaffirmed in films, on television, in the music they listen to, and by the so-called news media. From the moment children begin perceiving the world around them, they are inundated with progressivism. I doubt most parents realize it. They've been fully indoctrinated themselves. I'm not blaming this all on Obama or even government in general. Certainly, poor leadership plays a part, but there is a cause and effect dimension to the decline of our culture. A corrupt government contributes to the corruption of the people, but the opposite is also true. You don't get the policymakers we have now unless the people themselves are already corrupted. It's very much a vicious circle. Remember, politicians, entertainers, and media peddle envy politics, trashy entertainment, junk science, and substandard journalism only because there is demand for it. Some of the blame for Government Zero rests squarely on the people's shoulders. Hollywood's War on American Culture. As I tell my listeners on The Savage Nation, follow the money. Late last year, Governor Jerry Brown signed a bill tripling the tax break incentives for Hollywood. As with all crony capitalism, the cover story is this will keep jobs from moving out of state or overseas. In reality, it's just another arm of the government media complex that is waging all-out war on American culture. Multimillionaire film moguls like Harvey Weinstein and Jeffrey Katzenberg get even richer. In return, they make movies that promote a message the progressives in the state and federal governments approve of. And what the progressives in government approve of are anti-capitalist, anti-religion, anti-military, or in short, anti-American films. When the film American Sniper attracted the biggest box office in decades and threatened to bring the people together in their love of country and the military, the harlots of Hollywood's left, with their fellow travelers in the media, began a campaign of hatred against the film and its hero. It was hatred and vitriol they don't express toward the Islamic barbarians who are raping, beheading, and conquering the Middle East as the Nazis did in Europe. Muslim students at the University of Michigan were successful in getting the college to cancel a screening of the film by claiming the film promoted anti-Muslim rhetoric and made them feel unsafe. The college announced its plans to stimulate the students' intellects with Paddington, a movie based on the stuffed animal, instead. Following news reporting of the decision, the university faced outrage on a national scale and eventually reversed its decision. But these are the kinds of tactics used to attack American culture and patriotism every day on campuses and elsewhere. As usual, Muslims teamed up with progressives to silence any voice not uttering the progressive Islamist narrative. For those who actually watched the movie, it doesn't glorify war. I'm an anti-war conservative and believe war is the worst thing that can happen to any society. It should be avoided at all costs and always be a last resort. But when civilization itself is under attack by barbarians who set people on fire while they are still alive, it has to be defended by somebody. The movie depicts war as it actually is. The whole reason soldiers are heroic is they do a job nobody wants to do, but which has to be done. They do it at great personal risk to defend civilization. Some of them make the ultimate sacrifice. so that we can go on writing books and making movies and enjoying the blessings of liberty. Clint Eastwood made a film celebrating these heroes and portraying those who fight for civilization positively, and people flocked to the theaters to see it. The left could not let this verdict stand. Just like the Red Guards had done in Mao's China during the so-called Cultural Revolution, America's Red Brigades worked tirelessly to demoralize and defeat their natural enemy, the most productive, patriotic citizens of America, who were naturally drawn toward a film that affirmed their values. That's why you have Hollywood attacking American values with their movies. Out of one side of their hypocritical mouths, they're anti-gun. Out of the other, they make movies rife with gunfights, knifing, butchering, murdering, and mayhem. Harvey Weinstein is one of the worst. Last year, he said he was going to make a movie with Meryl Streep that would make the NRA wish they weren't alive after I'm done with them. He promised in the same interview to stop making movies glamorizing guns. Over a year later, he still hasn't made his anti-gun movie, but he has obviously decided to break his vow against making violent movies. He currently has Kill Bill Volume 3, a remake of The Crow, and another Quentin Tarantino movie, The Hateful Eight, in production. So much for no more violent movies. Even Weinstein's claim that he's never owned a gun and doesn't want one is disingenuous. He may not own a gun personally, but he has a large cadre of armed bodyguards who provide him protection the average American can't afford. I'm not sure if that makes him more or less hypocritical than Dianne Feinstein, who actually has a concealed carry permit herself. Sean Penn is another Hollywood elitist, peddling hypocritical anti-gun nonsense. Penn used to be an unrepentant gun owner until a few years ago. In 2013, he sold his gun collection to an artist to be melted down for sculpture, apparently because his new girlfriend at the time didn't like them. Of course, once Penn decided he didn't want guns, he immediately concluded no one else should have them either, even though most people can't afford the armed bodyguards he and Weinstein can rely on when they are unarmed personally. Penn's newest movie is called The Gunman. I couldn't make this up. He actually starred in a typical Hollywood shoot-'em-up action film immediately after attacking the Second Amendment and calling guns cowardly killing machines. Meanwhile, I haven't heard anything about him disarming his bodyguards. Jeffrey Katzenberg and David Geffen are also living a life of luxury from their for-profit film and music ventures, but raise millions for leftist politicians who attack everyone else trying to make an honest living. We'll have to see if Geffen can beat out Weinstein and Penn for Hypocrite of the Year. After raising money for Bill Clinton in the 1990s, he had a falling out with him when Clinton refused to pardon Leonard Peltier. Geffen indirectly called the Clintons liars in a 2007 interview when he was backing Obama. He called Hillary Clinton an incredibly polarizing figure. Let's see if he still thinks she's polarizing now that it's her or a Republican for president. One of his spokesmouths already confirmed he'll vote for her, even if he believes she's polarizing and a liar. Hollywood is awash with the usual liberal hypocrisy. Capitalism and profits for me, and socialism and misery for everyone else. They make billions on movies glorifying guns and have concealed carry permits or armed bodyguards themselves, but want to ban guns and free enterprise for you and me. Any film affirming patriotism, love of God and country, entrepreneurship, self-reliance, independent thinking, or any of the other heroic qualities inherent in the American ethos must be vilified out of existence. The supposed evil of capitalism is another recurrent theme in almost every movie. Entrepreneurs are villains. Corporations become large and successful not by producing products that millions of people choose to buy, but by murdering people. If a businessman is the hero in a movie, he is heroic only if, by the end of the movie, he rejects capitalism and the profit motive and learns how wrong he was to believe in free enterprise. If he is a white male, he also has to learn how inherently evil he is because of that. You've probably been exposed to this without even realizing it. Do you like science fiction movies? The Alien franchise was popular enough to spawn several sequels. They were pretty good movies, if you like science fiction, especially the original. But they all peddled the usual socialist propaganda. The real villain of the films was an evil corporation, willing to sacrifice the lives of its employees to bring back the alien life form for some unknown purpose. We learned during the sequel that the company was interested in selling the organism to the military. So, the Hollywood Marxists managed to smear Free Enterprise and the military at the same time. What a bargain! That corporations have to murder people to succeed is a fairly common theme coming out of Leninist Hollywood. The Fugitive and Total Recall are two other popular examples. These are just fictional stories, but they constantly reinforce the leftist idea that for-profit businesses can make money only by harming people in some way. It's the tired zero-sum game fallacy. One economic actor can profit only if another realizes a loss. The idea of two parties trading to their mutual benefit is just beyond the comprehension of these freedom-hating subversives. If your tastes run more to romantic comedy rather than action or science fiction, you don't have to worry about missing out on leftist propaganda. In 2 weeks' notice, with Sandra Bullock and Hugh Grant, Grant's character must learn not to act in the best interests of the company's shareholders, among other things. In the especially awful Sweet November, Keanu Reeves must learn how evil he is for being hard-working and devoted to his career, in addition to learning how bad he is just for being a man. He is taught all of this by Charlize Theron's character, whom we learn over the course of the film is apparently sleeping with a different man every month in order to save them from their evil selves before dying of cancer at the end of the film. Believe it or not, Hollywood wasn't always like this. Yes, liberals have always infested the arts, from filmmakers to actors to musicians to painters. But just as in American politics, there was once a strong opposition party in Hollywood. Conservative icons like John Ford, John Wayne, Gary Cooper, and Spencer Tracy once made films that affirmed American values. They celebrated capitalism, patriotism, heroism in battle, and resistance to tyranny. Back in those days, the left wasn't so bold in coming out against movies celebrating America's heroes on the battlefield. Even the liberal New York Times said that 1949's Sands of Iwo Jima had so much that reflects the true glory of the Marine Corps' contribution to victory in the Pacific that the film has undeniable moments of greatness. The reviewer regrets that the movie didn't portray the Marines more realistically off the battlefield, as that didn't do enough justice to the U.S. Marines. Hollywood movies actually celebrated capitalism, too. One of my favorites was a film called Boomtown with Clark Gable and Spencer